Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to an adventure in history. We are rounding out the month of June, about to head into July, and we're so happy that it's summertime. Thank you for joining us. We have a special guest here tonight.
We do.
Yeah.
And somebody that, okay, you know, people sometimes talk about, well, I moved to a story and I didn't know how to get involved. This guy could give seminars on how to get involved.
This wasn't a problem. And we love all the organizations that he's involved with.
Well, we like 3 out of 4. No.
Oh, 3 out of 4.
We like them.
Okay.
All.
Say, which is the fourth one?
He picks well. He does pick really well.
Mike Brocious, thank you.
Well, thank you
for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm honored that you guys would take the time to talk to me.
Well,
he's like, what are we doing?
We'll see if you're still honored in 28 minutes. You might make, you're suddenly choosing, rethinking your life decisions after agreeing to be here. All right, because this could be a 5-parter.
It could be.
It really could. So we should get right to it. We don't have anything to plug.
No.
Because it's summertime activities, so nothing to plug.
I mean, do you have anything going on the first week of July, Mac?
Oh, we have everything going on.
There's tons. I mean,
yeah, it's the summertime, so come on.
Yeah, 4th of July coming up, lots of opportunities. But I do have a word.
All right.
This is something that you don't necessarily do on the 4th of July. I don't know if that'll work or not. Prandicle. Prandicle.
Prandicle. And it's a...
It's a noun. A person, noun. Place, or thing.
A prandicle. I think it is a... I always guess first, so you can appear a little smarter than I am. Prandicle. I think that is a thing that should be fun, but it turns out not to be fun. Like, we're going to go to a family barbecue. We thought it was going to be great. And then, like, my cousin got drunk and caused a fight.
No, but that could be used to describe this, though. Okay. So
could be. Used,
I mean, there's no context either. So, I mean, your chance of getting it right
is,
you know,
like zero.
Well, not if you're Mac Burns.
Oh, no.
He's got. Yeah. I won't tell you how many he's got.
I know. I've heard some of them that he got. And he go, how the heck did he figure that out?
He's only had 2.
Yeah. Oh, has he?
Yeah. He's at 2.
And we've been doing this for at least a year.
Yeah.
Prandicle. I have no idea. Let's see. I don't even know that I can make a guess. Let's see. Mac says it's something that you would do at if your party that was going to be good and it turned out to be a prandicle because it was screwed up. That sounds pretty good. I am going to have to pass.
This is a small meal.
A small meal. That's it.
That's it. Prandicle.
A prandicle.
So I ate tapas, appetizers, or a prandicle.
A prandicle.
I just want a prandicle.
I like the word.
With my
I don't
glass
know
of wine.
Back.
Just want a small meal.
It's like an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah.
Is it a meal or is it just a small helping?
A small meal.
A small meal. Okay. What? That's... Prandicle. It's fun to say prandicle.
It's kind of fun to say.
See, it's better than appetizer.
Yes.
I agree.
I'll have a prandicle before we start our main course. Okay.
All right. Moving on.
So these are the history highlights, things that are happening tomorrow, July 1st. So perhaps you can save these and get ready for your July 4th family get-togethers. And I marked a few without, I want to not give the dates because I want to see if you all can guess. So the first Sony Walkman goes on sale. What year? I was totally wrong on this when I was guessing.
I would say 65.
Wow. Not correct, but early.
I'm going to say 1970.
See, I was thinking like 84, 85, 79.
Oh, 79.
July 1st, 1979. Okay, then zip codes. When are they introduced to the U.S. mail?
Oh, interesting. Zip codes.
For bonus points, not that we're keeping track, but what does ZIP stand for?
Oh, I have no idea. I'm going to say 1935. And yeah, ZIP, I don't know. Is it an acronym for something?
It is.
Is it really?
Yeah. Which I don't really quite get. I need to do a deeper dive on that.
Okay.
Any guesses or shall I just
go? I would say, yeah, probably 1922.
63.
What?
Doesn't seem really late.
How the heck did they deliver mail until 60 with zip code? No zip codes.
And zip codes, ZIP stands for Zone Improvement Plan.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. And then this one's just for you, Mike. The Tour de France inaugural race, the first year.
Oh, 110.
Because you like riding bikes.
I do. I would say, was it 1895?
Wow, that's a lot closer than I would have, like, just off the top of my head, thought about. 1903.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that does not seem crazy early to you.
Well, it seems crazier to me based on what the equipment that they had and what they tried to do. Yeah, those guys were crazy people.
All right. So the rest of that was fun. The rest of the history highlights, though, things that happened on July 1st, 1200.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I usually like don't go that back one. That far.
Yeah.
In China. Usually if I'm doing something that early, it's going to end up being in China. Sunglasses are invented.
I love that.
Way to go, Chinese.
Wow.
Inventing sunk. I almost made that the history highlight of the day.
And documented.
Documented, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure at some point some caveman like held a leaf in front of his face or something. China, 1200. 1874, the first zoo in the U.S. opens in Philadelphia. And I don't know if we've discussed zoos before. How do we feel about zoos?
I love the Oregon Zoo.
It is a pretty good zoo.
Yep. I think that I'll stop there.
I just always feel a little sad. For the animals. I don't know.
The Oregon Zoo does go above and beyond.
Yes. 1898, the Battle of San Juan Hill. Teddy Roosevelt. Okay, I do love Teddy Roosevelt, but I'm not really going to get into this discussion. 1908, the SOS distress signal becomes the worldwide standard for help.
Okay.
SOS. 1966, Medicare goes into effect. All right, moving on. 1984, PG-13 rating debuts. PG-13. All right. 1997, Hong Kong is returned to China. 2000, Vermont civil union laws go into effect. I was in Vermont during this.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. Governor Howard Dean.
Okay. And it was,
one of my board members was in the, whatever the equivalent of the state legislature was, state senator, I'm not sure. But it was an all-night session. There were people outside protesting or in favor of, and it was really kind of ugly.
Yeah.
And they were all night on this thing. And then they came out at like 5 in the morning, all disheveled. And they're like, okay, we've come to an agreement. And they introduced civil unions.
Yeah, it's great.
And half the crowd cheered, half the crowd booed. And it was a mixture because it wasn't far enough. It wasn't marriage.
Right.
You didn't go far enough. And others, this was a horrible slippery slope we're going down.
Sure.
And
in Vermont,
like everybody was just angry at everybody. And then everybody was kind of happy at the same time. That was amazing. All right. But that's July 1st, 2000. But our history highlight of the day thing I think had the most impact on history, 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg begins. Mm. Gettysburg. And you've never been.
Nope.
Have you ever been to the?
I have.
It's a powerful place.
It's powerful. It's sad and powerful.
Yeah. I'm always stunned just like looking at Pickett's charge, this big giant open field. And these guys were just jumping out of a trench and running across into a hail of bullets. And I just think you'd have to poke me in the butt so hard with that bayonet to get me come out of the trench.
Yeah.
The inside fortitude that these people had.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know of a transition there.
I know that
interior fortitude.
Yes.
I try to come up with some segue to you, but I can't. Cooled houses. You know, there's the houses that one of the cannonballs goes through the guy's barn there in the middle of the field.
There you go.
I don't know if any cannonballs went through your house.
Someone that's here to make an impact on the world. Mike Brocious is our guest. Again, thank you for joining us. I just trampled all over your transition.
You did.
That wasn't
well.
Working.
I wasn't going anywhere. I know. So you could have taken the hook on me about a minute earlier. So before we get into your background, name the organizations that you have become involved in a very short period of time here in Astoria. Like, how might people know you already?
Well, I'm on the board with the Liberty Theater, the Hospital Foundation Board, of course, the Clatsop Historical Museum Board.
Of course, I like.
Of course,
that.
Working. A lot with the college and doing a number of other things. We're starting a new project, a little project called the Blue Zones. We'll be starting that in the next few weeks, hopefully. So pretty engaged in a lot of the stuff going on, I guess.
And what I kind of like about that is there are some people that get focused into like one area. Like I'm all about education or I'm all about healthcare. I think you kind of fit in the box of anything that might be good for the community.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to do it. And then my wife, who, you know, on the other side, she's involved in the animal shelter and the gardening, master gardening program. So we kind of have the gamut of pretty much the family. We kind of split stuff up.
We should have listed what you're not involved in. Right. That might have been a little faster. So I do want to talk about, because people also know about your house, but I like to say it's the second best house in Astoria. You can argue with me and I'll accept that argument. But how did you, what's your background? Where'd you grow up and how did you come to be in Astoria at some point in your life?
Well, I grew up in northern Minnesota where, you know, it's a great place to be from. And all the winters were 35 below and 80 below zero with wind chill. And it was a good place to grow up, but a good place to be from. And then from there, I just, you know, graduated from the University of North Dakota, which, yes, there is a university in North Dakota, I have to remind people. And then went to work in Denver, which is where I met my wife to be, working for Target stores in, what year was that? 81. And then from there, I went to LA with Target. And then fortunately met some people that had worked with some people that were starting this new company called Costco.
Oh, wow.
You know, in 84, I went in 85. At the time, I think Costco, we had maybe 14 or 15 warehouses and maybe we did $1 billion in sales. I don't even know if we did that. And I remember talking to Jim, the founder, and said, what do you think this is going to be? I think we could do 35 or 40 warehouses maybe in 5 or 10 years. And, you know, here we are today, a number Fortune 10 company.
Yeah. I had no idea Costco was that young.
I didn't either. I was going to say, now we have to go back and
do a whole
deep dive
on
Costco.
Yeah.
Yeah, it started in 83.
And were they all spinoff folks that had worked at Target?
Or? No, they weren't from Target at all. They had worked for FedMart, which was a division, which was in the 60s and 70s. And then FedMart got sold out to a German company, and some of them went to Price Club. Saul Price, who was the CEO of FedMart, started another company called Price Club, which is basically the precursor to Costco, and that was 76. So a bunch of them went to Price Club, and then when Jim and Jeff Brotman decided to start Costco, a lot of them came over to Costco that he had worked with at FedMart.
So where was the very first Costco?
Seattle, Washington, right on 4th Avenue.
Does it still exist at all?
The building does not exist. We put a new building on that site.
It's probably bigger.
It's right? Bigger and fancier. Yeah, I mean, back then, those buildings were pretty simple.
It was a warehouse.
It was a true warehouse back right. then. Yeah.
And from the beginning, was there always, you had to buy a membership? And secondly, were there always hot dogs?
Hot dogs started when Portland with Warm, Wonderful Jeans, who had a little cart in the warehouse, and he sold some hot dogs, and he had soda in an igloo cooler, and that was the foundation of the hot dog. And we didn't even actually own the business. He owned it and paid us rent. And we had membership, but in the beginning, you could be a free member, but you paid 5% surcharge. So you'd buy your stuff and you'd pay 5% more. And eventually we always tried to convert people saying, hey, you're paying 5%. You should just be a member. I think membership was $20 back then or something like that.
It is such an interesting concept too, right? Because I think if I would have been that person on the ground floor, I would have been like, no. You Never. Know, a warehouse, I have to pay to shop there.
Never going to work.
It's, you know, just bulk everything. And yeah, now it's like the go-to. Right. I mean,
yeah. Well, and you have to remember back then, nobody knew who we were. Right. So there was no Procter & Gamble and all. They didn't really want to sell to you because they didn't know, are you going to be around? Are you going to pay their bills?
True.
So you were mainly getting, in a lot of cases, tier two brand.
Oh, interesting.
Stuff,
okay.
You know,
so you're not the first employee. You're the second year in.
Second year in.
How many employees were there when you joined?
Oh,
roughly.
I would guess, you know, we had 5,000 maybe at the most, maybe 3,000. I'm trying to think, 200 people at a warehouse.
Yeah, because you were already.
Yeah, probably 3,000.
Interesting.
And we didn't warn you this was going to become a Costco show, and it's not going. We're going to move on.
Well, yeah.
But I do want one final. Like, how many Costcos are there now, or how many employees roughly would be?
Well, there's almost 900, and I think we're up to 370,000 employees worldwide.
Amazing.
It is.
Yeah. How cool.
Yeah. I always choose to tell Jim, the founder, and said, we won the job lottery. You know, because for having people still, I was there 36 years. Hmm. And, you know, it's the old IBM. That was the only other company way back when people would, you know, start off after school and stay their whole career. Costco's that way today, which is pretty, I can't think of another company that's like that.
Wow. So Costco has been good to you, and you were not living in Astoria. You were at the home base, Seattle.
Yep.
And how did you find Astoria? And why did you find Astoria?
Well, so 1985, when I went to work for Costco, we were working in Portland. So when we were there, and really my wife has always been an old home person. I didn't know what an old house was, but she's always been there and always wanted an old house. So we would come to the coast whenever we could. So we would come through Astoria, and we had lived in San Jose driven through San Francisco and stuff like that. And we thought, this is kind of like a miniature San Francisco. And we go, we could live in 1985. Astoria was not exactly the happening place, right?
Right.
But we loved the environment. We loved the idea that it was a working town and the architecture was cool. We said, someday this might be where we want to retire to. And someday happened.
Amazing.
I know. Full circle.
And you found a house after much searching and looking at other houses, including the other Flavel house at one point.
Yes, yes.
But talk about your house a little bit, because it is a work of art, and I know it's a passion project.
Yeah, well, we started looking in around 2013 when we came back from Atlanta. And we said, we need to start looking at where are we going to eventually retire to. And we looked at Bellingham, and we looked at Port Townsend and Port Angeles, and that story just kept drawing us. So we started looking, and we drove our realtor absolutely nuts, because we would look at a house, that's not quite what we want. And this house was for sale for three or four years maybe before we bought. We thought it was overpriced and needed a lot of work and da-da-da-da-da. So we kept passing on it. And we put our offer in a couple of other houses and didn't get it. And the house just kept calling me. Didn't necessarily call Laura. Laura saw the amount of work and go, I don't know if I want to do this again. But we have done maybe 6 or 7 restorations of older houses before. None quite this old. And found a passion. And Laura is unbelievably good at having a vision and figuring stuff out.
So how old is this house?
Built in between 1890 and 1892. I think okay. We're saying 1892. So it was built by Gustav Holmes, who was a cannery owner, owned a bunch of the canneries along the waterfront, along with his partner, Benjamin Young, who built another house, two blocks away from ours. And it's unusual that most of the nice houses are in the downtown corridor, and we happen to be in Upper Town, which is really a little bit unusual.
But it's kind of in the perfect spot, though, I think. I don't know. It seems perfect there. It's a good view. It's visible, which I like, rather than cooped up in between some other houses or something. And it's not the full city block, is it? But it feels like it's got a huge lot.
It's 3/4 acre.
Okay.
So it's a good size lot on the hill, and the views are spectacular. And that's the other thing that drove us to Astoria. It's like we originally were looking at, Laura was saying, well, do we want to be on the ocean? And I said, no, I don't want to be on the river, because there's always something happening on the river. There's constantly traffic. So it's a fantastic place to be.
And you have employed local people, and you've done the preservation right. That's how I think we got to know each other first, was you came in doing research in our archives, and then you're also friendly with the Lower Columbia Preservation Society. So you weren't just like, hey, I want to knock out walls and I want to put in giant screen TVs or something. You were very respectful of the house.
Yeah, I mean, our goal when we bought the house was to, you know, we didn't want to make it a museum per se, but we wanted to honor the history of it. And so I consider ourselves preservationists, and that was the goal. So we were fortunate. You know, when we got here, we go, oh God, how are we going to find people to do what our vision was? And we were fortunate that we found some unbelievably great craftspeople. Now, I will tell you that if you talk to them, they're all going to tell you they had to up their game. Because my wife is somebody that could look at a wall and go, that's off by 1/16 of an inch. And they go, no, 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 no. And they go measure and they go, it's off by 1/16 of an inch. And she would drive them crazy. But having said that, you know, she had the vision, and they had to up their game in order to match their vision, and they did. We were very, very lucky to find the people.
Do we want to give a shout out to some of those people?
Yeah, I'd love to. Joe Lupkin Brown, unbelievable talent with all the houses wood grained, and there's trompe l'oeil throughout the house that she had to recreate. And you know, she had done that on the movie sets to some extent, but like she said, hey, we were just slapping it up and getting to the next thing. And this time she had to do it in a whole different quality of aspect. Her daughter Faith helped. And then Christy Mather was unbelievable. She came in, and Christy is like the everything woman, my Laura always said. She can paint, she can plaster, she can faux, she refinished a bunch of furniture for us. There was nothing that Christy couldn't figure out how to do. So we were lucky there. And then the carpenters with Drew Olson and Ben Crockett were, again, always up for whatever we needed to do. They figured it out. So they were great. And Simo Ranto mm-hmm. did the painting on the outside and helped with a bunch of stuff on the inside. And we were just really lucky to get the craftspeople we got. And they were up to every task that we could figure out.
And it's how great that people like that are right here in our community, that you don't have to try to import somebody from Portland or Seattle or the East Coast, that there are these skilled craftspeople that love and respect and know how to do this work.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that our message to others is that those people exist in the world, throughout the country, in different small cities. You just have to sometimes find them. And you have to be patient because they're busy. And there's not many of them, so my advice is always wait for the right people, match your vision, and you're gonna and be patient, which is not in my normal forte. It's like get it done and move on.
And your finished product, although an old house is never finished, there's always going to be something, but it's been featured in some national publications just recently.
Yeah, it was in National Preservation Magazine, and then Old House Journal did a feature on the library, and then Old House Journal was just here Thursday and Friday this week to do a bunch of the preservation that we had done in various rooms, and then a full story coming up in the next few months, probably.
That's exciting. Sweet. So this connection to your community also goes into the other organizations that you choose to support. Where did this come from in your life? Was this with your family? Is this something you got in college?
I think, part of it was Costco, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, the organization is one that gives back to the community in a lot of different ways. So I think some of it came from that. And I'll be honest, part of it is it's your legacy. What are you going to do as you get old? We were blessed. I mean, we won the job lottery. So we were financially able to do a lot of things, and we've tried to teach our kids. It's not what you accomplish in life; it's what you leave behind that's really going to make the difference, and that's kind of the mantra.
So we didn't talk at all about your parents, but following up on that question, were your parents at all philanthropic involved or volunteered? Or is it something truly that you picked up in your adult life?
Well, my parents were, we were the classic middle class at best. My dad was an over-the-road truck driver that owned his trucks and worked 6 days a week and 80 hours a week.
Wow.
So, no, they didn't have any philanthropy, and they just were working class people.
Yeah. So it's even more remarkable that you have so taken to it, not having had that firsthand experience of being dragged along when your parents were volunteering or seeing them write big checks or even small checks or anything like that. So that's remarkable. Well done. So we've got about 5 minutes left. So I do want to make sure we talk about some of the projects you're involved in. And we've talked about Oregon Film Museum a lot, so I'll let you off the hook. You don't have to feel guilty.
It's one of my favorites.
But Kids Make Theater or Blue Zone, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I guess Kids Make Theater at the Liberty, when we first came here, that was the organization we got involved in the first, in the beginning, was, what was going on at the Liberty Theater. So we met Jennifer Crockett, and I just said, hey, if we were to give you X amount of money, what is the one thing that you think the community needs? And came back maybe a month later and said, we think a kids theater is really where we want to go. I go, well, what's it going to cost? And she gave a number. And I go, whoa, okay. And Laura and I said, let's do it. And fortunately, our kids were already in various arts. So we were very supportive of that. And, it went from a zero, 100 a year ago to now, I think we've had 350 kids and roughly 800 classes have been taken, and that's in a year's time. So Jennifer and Hillary have done a fantastic job there.
It's amazing, I'll just say, because both my kids have done it, and my niece and nephew. And so it's four different ages too, because I like that. The age breakdown is pretty small too, right? So it's they're pretty close in age, meaning that they're with true peers. And I love it. They're different themes, they're different skill levels. And then also the opportunity just to, I mean, this was lacking. You were right. This was not something offered anywhere here aside from some community theater for the kids that made it past the audition, right? So this was, I mean, a real niche that needed to be filled. And like you said, yes, I mean, it's different kids too that are taking it every time, and very affordable, like really, really low price point, or zero for scholarships if parents or kids aren't able to afford.
And
even
they're learning life-changing skills.
They are.
I mean, that's the thing that I find so amazing is these are skills. Whether they ever get stay in performing arts, who cares?
They're learning. Beautiful space too, right? I mean, it's not in a like a little theater. I mean, it's the Liberty Theater, so it's lovely.
I was hoping I could bait you into, and you were really close to saying it, something I've heard you say both about the Film Museum and the Kids Make Theater, that the numbers are great, how many kids have been involved, and they are life lessons. But if one kid, and you say this with such sincerity, that if one kid.
Yeah, I mean, if you impact one kid's life, you're impacting that person's life forever, not to mention the generations that they probably are going to impact. So.
I'm not even going to go into Blue Zones because I want to come back and just do an episode on Blue Zones, because I think that between Mike and I and Mac too, we can talk about that the whole time. So the other thing on Kids Make Theater is they also offer some of the tech teaching, right? So if the kids don't want to be on stage, they learn the behind the scenes, and they now have their own little, is it called Black Box Stage?
Yep. We created a Black Box Stage upstairs where they can create their own stuff, and in a much smaller environment. You know, I mean,
right.
To try to do something in the Liberty with 600 people,
downstairs,
you get lost. But if you can create something, I was just at an event a couple weeks ago with Gearhart was here with their theater group, and it was fantastic.
I love that.
Okay, so, you know, usually we ask a question towards the end. Ilana usually asks about what keeps you here, but you came here, so we know what keeps you here, but talk about not projects that you do for the community or that you're involved in, just some of your passions. I know that you, like we talked about bike riding at the very beginning. What are some of your passions that people may not know about?
Well, I love to bike ride. As a matter of fact, I'm leaving in a couple of days to Switzerland to do some bike riding in Switzerland with some friends. We've got some classic old cars that we have and that we really love to drive around. And, you know, we just spend a lot of time with friends and family. And, you know, fortunately, Astoria has just become, it's a small town that just kind of, if you want to get engaged, you can get as engaged as you want to. And we've just had a blast here.
Man, did we luck out with this family moving here or what, Mac?
We did. We won the retiree.
We did. Lottery. There's the theme. Thank you, Mike Brocious, for joining us tonight. And we are, like I said, so your homework, all of our listeners, look up Blue Zones, read the book. There's also shows out there as well, but Google it, and then we're going to bring Mike back and talk just about that here in Astoria.
Excellent. Go make some history. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here, and we'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.